Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This week, I'm introducing you to a gal who's after my own heart. Susan Hensley believes in play. She believes in creativity. She believes in art. She believes that we all need a space and a place to discover what makes our hearts sing. And I really just loved meeting her. She has been a journalist. She's worked in HR. She's done the 9-to-5 grind. She has been out there along with most of the rest of us trying to create a fulfilled and beautiful life. And so one day, you know, Susan was confronted with, you know, what brings me joy? What makes my heart happy? And she discovered it at a gathering at her friend's house. And she talks a little bit about that later in this episode. But suffice it to say that Susan discovered something that day that changed her life and just might change all of ours. But I'll let Susan tell you all about that a little bit later in this podcast. Yet another excellent human being in this world who's creating beauty and bringing gifts to us, gifts we didn't even know we needed. So now, without further ado, here's my interview with Susan Hensley.
I had open heart surgery when I was 4. And I remember it very well. So 4 is pretty young for clear memories. I had a birth defect. And so that's when they fixed it. And I remember being in the hospital and not being particularly afraid. My memories are like the light, the pure golden light coming through, feeling loved, feeling safe. Back in the day, this was a long time ago. You were in wards, like in private rooms. And I was with there because heart surgeries, open heart surgery is so serious back, you know, 1968, to give folks my age. And I don't mind that. But, you know, because you're also with the very sick children who maybe had cancer and other things. And so just even seeing other children, even though mine was to fix something and I got discharged to, were very ill, I ended up feeling God's presence then. You know, so much I think of introducing myself is about the audience, because we are so multifaceted, right? And you know, for your audience, and it's true for any, I'm evolving. I'm, you know, a human at this unique time with really deep spiritual interests, but also deep attachment to the planet, to its beauty, and to being part of culture, right? I was raised to sort of achieve, and I like that. I see that the downside of always focusing on success, but there's also a lot of beauty in sort of goals and pursuits of passions. I think it's part of the human experience. And so it's, I feel like it's such a funny answer. If you had asked me that question at 13, at 18, at 22, at 25, at 40, I would have been like, I mean, probably even 5 years ago. And now it's like, I'm sort of exploring. The world is surprising me, and I'm trying to be really curious and not assume that I know everything. I feel like there's just way too many strong opinions and not enough just curiosity and prayer. Big fan of like prayer or peace. And because I do think we create a certain world.
Thank you. I love that answer. I just want to tell you, because I have said this before, curiosity is a superpower. I wish, you know, some people actually out in the world just don't seem to be curious
about anything. And I just think to myself, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I'm not like that, because I think curiosity allows you to bump into strangers who potentially can become your friends, you know, study maybe the architecture of a different nation or country, or draw you to studying some rare tree frog in some South American jungle, or even just going down to the library and picking a book that looks interesting to you. And I think curiosity, well, here's a question for you. Do you think curiosity and creativity are linked?
Absolutely. I will even go as far as saying, I don't know how there's one without the other, because I think the basis of creativity is, what if? Like, what am I feeling? What is moving through me? And how can it be expressed? That's how, at least I think of creativity. I think sometimes we get very narrow definitions of certain things, of curiosity and creativity. And as I get older, I think both are so broad, and they link to awe, they link to compassion, they link to presence and wonder, right? It's, they are like a really foundational piece of a happy life. And I think sometimes a lack of curiosity can be rooted in fear. It's like, if I'm curious, I may have questions I can't answer. I may have to sit with mystery or ambiguity or unknown. And that can be very, very uncomfortable.
I think most people don't like to be uncomfortable. They're running away from it as fast as they can. When you were a kid, did you think you'd be doing the work, or can you see the path to where you're doing the work that you're doing now?
You know, in some ways I can. It's not direct. I use a lot of imagery of like a spiral staircase, I think, as we evolve, and how certain things build on other things, and how at different times, I didn't take certain turns, either because I wasn't ready or culture, or I was going down another path. But yeah, I would say it is not surprising if you look back and in different parts of my work, whether it's a lifetime line or a journey line or whatever, as people sort of map their lives, you can see that through thread of certain interests.
I love that. I'm actually really curious. As a kid, were you creative? Now, I was creative as a kid. I grew up overseas and was very, very creative. But then when we came back to the States, my parents started getting divorced. And so for me, the creativity was a way of kind of just actually divorcing myself from what was going on in the family home. So whether it was disappearing into reading books, being like just a devourer of books, or doing little projects at school, doing posters for school or whatever, that creativity really helped keep me, or helped me to feel safe, I guess, or gave me a safe place to kind of, I don't know, be happy or not think about the stress that was going on in my outside life. Does that make any sense?
Well, it absolutely makes sense. And I appreciate you sharing, because right, there's outlets, there's escape, there's like that subconscious processing of what's going on, right? I mean, I'm sort of the mindset that if we can learn to see our emotions and separate from them, knowing, you know, at a moment they overwhelm us and it feels like that's who we are. I am rage, I am fear, I am anxiety. Many times it's the tougher ones, right? Very rarely we're like, I am joy, I am love, but we are much more those things than the other. But one of the really great practices that I found with art journaling, and just for the sake of the audience, they may know this, art journaling isn't about producing any art. It's exactly like keeping a written journal. It's the process, but you're using colors and images, not necessarily words. So it really kicks you over to the right hemisphere of your brain, right? To that very holistic, intuitive space. And that's clearly what you are doing, right? As a child during those periods, because that is the space where we feel peace, we feel belonging. Subconsciously, we can work things out that we don't have always using the left side of our brain, the words or ability to figure out. And I think for me, playing with art, because I don't identify myself. I mean, you're in a very creative artistic community as a, like I would say, a capital A artist. I play with crayons and color and the things of like a five-year-old when you're really to move myself into that state of play and curiosity and self-compassion. So for me, they are tools to move myself to that place, just like my meditation practice or written journaling are also tools. I just find sometimes the color in the art to be faster, and I have much less of that inner critic trailing me.
Do you use a lot of glitter? Because I love glitter.
So oh, interesting. Much. I don't use a lot of glitter, but glitter is fantastic. What I love, and it's really interesting to think about, is I recommend to anyone, use the art things you used as a kid. Like, what were your very favorite? So I am quite in love, like with the purple, I'm just going to say the brand Elmer's glue stick. And my crayons and the watercolors, because I had no glitter as a young child, apparently. But I love like tearing collage, any junk mail, any travel brochures, anytime I go somewhere and I can find an extra magazine and just putting, because I use the big thick glue stick and it's like smearing the glue and pasting it. And so I end up doing a lot of collage, a lot of just with crayons, messy watercolors. So those have sort of been my go-tos. But when I taught the workshops and even online, you use what you love. So people who love glitter, people who love stickers, people keep greeting cards and tear them up, tissue paper. I mean, there's so many things, leaves, that if they spark that joy and curiosity, right, we sort of become treasure hunters to what happens during the day that sparks that little like moment of glimmer. And so glitter's fantastic. Yeah, I love that.
Thank you for your ratification of glitter. I appreciate
it. Oh, yeah.
I'd really like to ask you, because you brought up prayer earlier, and I think prayer is so powerful. You know, even if you're just maybe praying for yourself, I mean, I know lots of people would say, oh, I don't really pray and I don't believe in it, but, you know, they'll petition the universe. You know, they'll say, maybe even unconsciously, oh my gosh, it would be so great to get an extra day off this week. Or, you know what I mean? It's like they're not really aware that they're doing it. And I think prayer is really important because I think it can shift worlds, you know, not only your own, but other people's worlds. But so did you grow up in a religious household? I mean, was prayer involved when you were a child? And then how did that evolve over time?
Sure. So grew up in a semi-religious household, was raised Catholic. My mom grew up in a religious household, Catholic. And so I was raised that way. But when I was with my grandparents, maternal grandparents, they said the rosary every night out loud. I spent a lot of time with them. So deeply meditative, repetitive prayer. And I would be a little kid, probably back before I even knew the prayers, but I could appreciate the rhythm and that the chanting. So definitely knew how to pray and had that Catholicism as a religious background and went through all through confirmation. Where I was growing up at the time in Northern California, my mom really is a spiritual explorer. And so she was also introducing, although that's her, you know, religion of origin, Buddhist principles and meditation. We always had a lot of books and different things around. So early on, I felt like I had this ability, and we were friends with a lot of people of different religions. And in high school, I belonged to a church group of a different religion. And it was really, it was helpful in terms of the diversity of what I call like the religious traditions that have a lot in common, which are, you know, forget the sort of the doctrine and the politics, if you will, of the religion, but just the, you know, living in presence, prayer, a moral code that is about helping others and compassion, right? Incredibly common. So I felt really fortunate that, yes, prayer felt natural. It could feel meditative. And it felt like a way to tap into something greater. I think some people are born recognizing there's something greater than you. I had open heart surgery when I was 4, and I remember it very well. So 4 is pretty young for clear memories. I had a birth defect, and so that's when they fixed it. And I remember being in the hospital and not being particularly afraid. My memories are like the light, the pure golden light coming through, feeling loved, feeling safe. Back in the day, this was a long time ago, you were in wards, like you didn't have private rooms. And I was with there because heart surgeries, open heart surgery is so serious back, you know, 1968, to give folks my age. And I don't mind that, but you know, cause you're also with the very sick children who maybe had cancer and other things. And so just even seeing other children, even though mine was to fix something and I got discharged, who were very ill, I ended up feeling, yeah, God's presence then. And I think that at such an early age, the rituals of my grandparents, you know, saying the rosary together, the curiosity of, you know, sort of where I was and exposure. And then I just think some people are more drawn to it, quite honestly.
Was just really struck by something you just said, because I hadn't, of course I know about saying the rosary, I know about it, but you just brought up the fact of the chanting, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, it's a little bit of a contemplative practice, because you're chanting and then the next bead and you're chanting. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, you know, that's what Buddhist monks do when they're, well, you know, trying to get out of themselves, you know. And then I was thinking about your journaling, yeah, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, the kind of play journaling, art journaling you're talking about also would probably help us get out of ourselves, you know, to kind of a, this contemplative place where we can heal or maybe get a message or be still. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. There was a point in my corporate career that we lived in Hong Kong and traveled all over Asia. And so went to a number of temples and watched the monks. And I will tell you, every time I saw that, I thought of my grandparents. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting. And at that point, as my meditation practice was deepening, it's like different because they emerged in different parts of the world at different times, and yet the same, right? There's a, and you can tell that as humans, there is something to the repetition, the contemplation, the tactile, the sensory, right? With the beads, as well as the prayer or the saying. And then, yes, you're right, the art journaling, all of those things move us really into a different space of processing. Absolutely. And I think, you know, in our modern society, individuals looking for something, finding what works for them, right? Where we are so unique. I mean, we all have the same wants, you know, to be seen, to be loved, to be safe, right? And yet, what works for me doesn't necessarily work for you, and vice versa. So when I put the book out in the train, it's like, if you try it for a few days and it's doing nothing for you, you know, low barrier to entry with art journaling. But if it hits, if it sparks joy, if it releases play, then it's not a should. It really becomes something you look forward to. And I think to put out offerings for people, because you just don't know what's going to work for someone.
I'm going to hopefully not put you on the spot with this question, but when we were traveling when I was a kid, I didn't really get to any Asia countries. I mean, we did go to Bangkok, but that was kind of the limit, or the extent, I guess I should say. So may I ask you, because I'd really like to know the answer, what was your favorite Asian country and why?
So here's where I'm not great, because I really don't have favorites. I'll tell you about a few who stand up, but here's the why. I'm a really passionate traveler, like 95 countries kind of passionate traveler, and I've lived abroad. And I think to travel that much, what it is and why I'm not great at answering the question is, I find it to all be curious. There's so many ways to live and structures and nature and air, and that I enjoy it also. Now, to answer your question in two very, very different reasons, Japan for developed, and it is fantastic. The people, the food, the culture, Kyoto, the temples, the precision, the beauty, the thought and care. And then I would say, it's interesting because there's a few in Southeast Asia, going to Vietnam, because as an American, I was a young child, very young, during Vietnam. So I don't remember anything, but maybe the tail end. You had one image and you see it all these years later. And it's such a interesting place between the history of first the French and then what happened in the war, and then how the countries evolved, and the fact that Americans are so unbelievably welcome. So there's a lot. I mean, same with Japan. You go to Tonga, where there's so much about reconciliation and different wars, and you would obviously get that in Europe, but you asked about Asia. So I would say Vietnam and Japan, but for very different reasons.
Thank you for that. I know it was a little bit of an unfair question.
No problem. I get asked it when people find out how much I travel. I get asked a lot, and I used to feel like I had to come up with an answer. And so no, the broader answer, you did not ask this, but I will say it. The favorite trips are the animal focused. So it's Africa, it's the Galapagos, it's the nature focused trips for me. And that's where what I call the really deep awe of this planet. And sort of, you know, that love, if you will, of Mother Earth and all its diversity comes through. Once again, it's not a country specific, it's an experience specific.
Yes, because I actually desperately want to go to Japan to do some forest bathing. And not only that, I mean, the temples, I mean, I just really want to admire and appreciate the beauty in real life in Japan, but specifically the forest bathing, because people talk about it all the time. And apparently the forests there are just unbelievable, unreal. And I'm really looking forward to that. It's kind of exciting for me. I mean, I've never wanted to go to Japan, but in the last couple of years, I just think, oh my gosh, I would really want to go to Japan.
Yeah, no, that would be terrific. It is quite beautiful and really interesting. And I think we're all drawn to different places too. It's, you know, sometimes you land and there's an energy, and as you're traveling, you get one set of energies. It's just, it's a great experience. It's my deep, deep passion, obviously.
I also think it's pretty fabulous that as a kid, you got to experience all these different cultures and all these different, you know, people who grow up in the States and don't leave, you know, they kind of have a skewed, I don't know, and maybe interpretation of the world, or maybe interpretation of other peoples in the world or other countries. But really, when you leave this place of comfort, this place where you kind of feel safe and you're like, I'm going to go out into the world, or your parents take you there. Yeah. It allows, it's like such a huge gift, and it allows you to understand that beauty is different everywhere. Food is definitely different everywhere. People are different everywhere, but that's not such a bad thing. And I'm curious, did you feel like your childhood gave you this, it was like an incredible gift?
Yeah. So let me clarify, actually, that Asia thing was me as an adult. We took my high school age son. So I, as a child, did not travel outside the U.S. I didn't first, I mean, maybe like Mexico because of where I grew up, but broader really didn't until I lived in London during college and then really traveled all over Europe. So most of my traveling came starting at about international, but then because I've lived with my job in a couple different countries, or my former job, that's really where the travel took off. But, you know, what it did show me, because I think we make assumptions, is how much people will help you, how safe. It's really interesting how we can tell ourselves stories about not being safe. And there have been some countries I've gone to that I've sort of felt like, oh, am I going to be safe? And it's like, it really reminds me, yes, people are helpful. They are kind. They aren't, like I said, they are just fundamentally, you know, in all of the travel we've had, I've been very fortunate. There've been very few what I would call even scary moments. If I ever am uncomfortable, I listen to that voice immediately. But I've been really, really fortunate at what I would say is the kindness of people all over the world.
Truly, that is truly. If I could tell you, I walked the Camino in 2013 for like 2.5 months. And if I mean, I was just telling someone the other day how kind, because I mostly walked through France. I took a different route from southern France to northern France and then along the Spanish coast. The amount of people who were so good to me and kind to me and gave me food or made sure I wasn't lost or stopped to ask if I needed help. I mean, it was unbelievable, the kindness and generosity of spirit.
Yeah. So I walked the Camino with a friend for 4 weeks. We started in Saint-Jean and then walked that way. So when you say that, but yeah, it was everything you thought and who you met at the beginning. And when you describe, if you stayed in the albergues, or I think in France, they probably have a slightly different name. I was in Spain most of the time. Yes. The people of all nationalities and everyone just sort of doing their thing and felt the same way. I think my expectation was that because of everything I'd read and all the other travel, but it really is quite an amazing, amazing experience.
It's so hard to explain to other people if they haven't done it. It's really, really challenging to explain. And I'm not quite sure why.
Well, I think that for me, when my friend and I went, and it was right after I left my corporate job, because I knew through art journaling, I was ready for a change and thought, oh, it'd be a great chance to get in touch with myself. I think it depends on the aspect that you're sharing with the person, because there are a lot of things that can sound wildly unappealing about it. And so I think it all depends on the how you come at it, for sure. And that's, I think, what makes it hard to describe to people, is so many people do it and it can be a great adventure, but it's also hard, and not just physically, but mentally. And there's a lot of discomfort in the way. And when I say the way you were raised, I was walking with my best friend, and she was the youngest of seven and had been in this major band and was used to sleeping on buses and in gymnasiums with like 70 other kids, right? She was much older, but she could sleep anywhere. I was the oldest of two, a boy and girl. And I get in that situation of, you know, these sort of sleeping dorms. And although I travel a lot, it's like, I will never sleep. Now you get over that, but the harder parts are different for everyone. And I struggled much more with the communal living and not having even the thinnest wall, even like a sheet around me so that I could feel like I was in a cocoon. And it made me recognize how I was raised. I've just always been a person sort of with their own space, and to not have that little space, that was one of my biggest challenges. It just made me examine I'm a product really of how I have lived. And although I felt safe, and we all are, it was, you know, when you go to sleep, you're so vulnerable feeling. And it's like, so I think everyone has something like that. For some, it's the walking. For some, it's, you know, the food, whatever it is. But, and that's why I think makes it hard to describe, as we all tell the more dramatic stories and people are like, oh my gosh.
Well, yes, I did not know what to expect. I did not do a ton of research. I kind of just, I actually took a ship from Miami to Barcelona, spent a week in Barcelona with a friend, and then took three trains to southern France and started walking. As I told everybody who asked me in France, where did you start walking from? I said, Arles. And they're like, we have no idea where that is. What is that? So I'd have to point on a map and they'd say, oh, Arles. And I'm like, yeah, that place. That's where I started. But wow. it was challenging. It was difficult. It was uncomfortable some days, but it was also, there were some of these transcendent just experiences and beautiful. I mean, just the French countryside. I mean, my God, I've never seen so much beauty in my life. Would you mind sharing a particularly beautiful memory from the Camino?
Oh, I have a few. Let me see. Which do I want to share? saw so much beauty. But I think for me, what was particularly beautiful, and it's about the letting go and about the acceptance I had. And that's what made it so beautiful. I didn't want to have to walk in bad weather, but we went really on the shoulder. We started and we hit snow initially and then lots of rain. And there was a day of sort of acceptance when we were walking in really heavy rain and mud and the rain sort of coming sideways. And you get, although there are places you can take buses in between, if you're not anywhere near them, if you're like on the trail in a vineyard, you there's no other way than through. Which is so obvious. And yet there's no better symbol when you're not in a separate life crisis, a health crisis, a divorce, right? I mean, there's all sorts of things that happen in our lives where there's clearly no other way but through, but you've put yourself, you have chosen. And it was so good for me to recognize I've made a choice. This is a choice. There is no option but to keep going, because there is no bus. There's definitely no car. There's no donkey. There is nothing other than to keep walking in the driving rain and the wind and the mud. And, but it's that combination of, this is absolutely a choice. I've put myself here and I need to go through, felt really transcendent in terms of being brave in our lives, recognizing we actually put ourselves in so many more situations, I think, than we accept. Like, how did I really get here? And it's easy to point at all these external factors. And yet the truth is we've made a series of decisions that have led us to a certain point. So I don't know if it was a sort of spiritually, morally beautiful moment for me on the Camino.
Thank you for sharing that. I hadn't even considered that before, but what a beautiful analogy between events that happen that you have to push through that you actually have chosen and events that maybe you haven't chosen and you have to go through. That's really beautiful. Thank you. I want to tell you that I really appreciate the cover of the book behind you, Art for Your Sanity. Partially, I think the reason I appreciate it is because it's so clean. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, the cover is so clean. It's just beautiful. It's like Art for Your Sanity. So how did this book come about?
So it was interesting. I had a first career in journalism, then several decades in a large corporation doing a series of jobs. And I started art journaling about 7 years ago. A colleague actually had a great side hustle as an artist. Like, she would produce art that people would commission. And we were all joking, as people do, I'm not creative. I'm not an artist, right? This is exactly where our conversation started. So she had a few of us over to her house. It's a rainy Saturday. And she had some paints and she was introducing the color wheel. And I sat there and I felt like a 5-year-old artist. And I made just sort of like, I didn't let the paints really dry. So I ended up with like a brown mess, but I loved this splotch I created. And it was so fun. And I was doing so much executive and career coaching at the time that I know to look for those moments of joy, right? I mean, that's a key fundamental to all the coaching when you're helping people to really discover their authentic self. And playing, not producing art, brought me such joy. So I actually took it home. I put it on the refrigerator. That's that being your own sort of proud parent. You know, my husband and son are like, you know, brown splotch, but okay. And we still had some art supplies at home. And that's why I was sort of playing with the crayons and things. And I just started to do that. And the pandemic hit, world got really hard, lots of very intense feelings. And I really doubled down on that practice. And I recognized it went from a source of play and creativity to really a container for difficult emotions, whether it was rage, fear, anxiety. I could draw little screaming faces. Once again, this is all very 5-year-old stuff, but the release for me, and you could turn the page on that emotion, or you could revisit it a few days later and paint will have dried and softened. And you can have compassion for that moment you were feeling that was very real, but you recognize it's not you, right? That's that whole, I'm not these emotions. And then after a few years, it took me a few years. Most people recognize this after a few months. I realized my art journal was actually talking to me. It was tapping into inner wisdom. It was telling me to take a leap, leave this job that although I loved the people and loved the company and still do, no longer fit, right? It was time to do something else. And when I really recognize how through the years I've done this, the inner wisdom, the symbols that start to emerge at different times, the pictures, if I'm collaging, I'm drawn to, I was sort of blown away. And so I was telling people like, my gosh, my art journal, 10 minutes a day or something, I play, feel creative. It holds all these intense emotions. And it's, you know, at different points, it's tapping into my more authentic self in a different way, in that right-brained way. So that's what eventually led me to write the book, because I was talking about it in my own coaching practice. I was telling anyone I would run into about it, right? Because I thought it was such a neat tool. And putting a book out, doing online training, just a way to reach more people, right? It's that whole, if you're at all curious, it's a low barrier to entry. It's private, and it can really fuel a lot, all three of those aspects in ourselves.
I do want to just tell you that I got weeded out of the journalism program at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, decades ago. The wonderful salt of the earth teacher who had written, I think, for the Sun-Times or something, said I used too many adjectives. I knew I was going to be a writer eventually, but I loved adjectives. I couldn't help it.
That's so funny, because the reason I thought I would never write a book and never write a personal book is I had a whole first career in journalism, and that the irony of it's like, no, because it's more, needs to be more descriptive. And this ended up being so personal. The funny thing about this book is it's like 109 pages with pictures. And at first I'm like, is it too short? And the editor who was helping me is like, did you say everything you needed to say? And it's like, yes. It's like, that's that journalism background. It's like, I'm not going to use any extra words. I'm going to try and describe honestly, because it's a combination of my personal experience with it, and then all the brain science, and then a little bit of how to. And it's funny how those first professions, well, everything shapes us. But the whole reason I said I would never write a book was the 11 years I spent in journalism, which was short, fact-based, no person of me in. And like I said, here I go and write an incredibly personal book with my own art pictures, only because I think people, until they see mine, they think it needs to be something big. It's really, there are screaming face emojis. There are hearts, there are collages. It is like, you know, when I was a little girl, I went by Susie. It is like 5-year-old Susie, but it's, like I said, it is tapping into something much deeper.
Thank you for that. I've had another journalist on here and we had a really interesting conversation. I asked her what her favorite beat was. Did you have a beat? Like, what was your favorite beat? I'm so curious.
I did a ton of health reporting. So I was in television news and I did consumer reporting courts. I mean, at some point, like I said, I did 11, 12 years, you sort of cover everything, but by far it was the health. And what I loved about it is it was trying to help people. It was forward thinking. It was, you know, what's the research that's coming? And I recognize, you know, this is where you start to see certain threads and why. When I did the consumer reporting, I was definitely helping people, but in many cases you had bad actors. Well, you did have bad actors, right? And you had that conflict. And I recognize I would rather sort of help people avoid things like that and talk about what's new and coming. It just, for me, individually, it's more fulfilling. So no, it was health reporting that I really, really enjoyed.
That's actually really fascinating because I bet you were privy before a lot of people, most people maybe, to cutting edge health techniques, surgeries, news, I guess you could say, around health or, you know, maybe the trends of everybody eating cherries the next year because dark cherries are good for you.
Yeah, no, I absolutely was. And several of the markets I was in television news were with large universities that had medical centers that were doing research. So that's also part of what made it so neat and really, you know, heartwarming things. And I recognize it's continued to be a, you know, a lifelong interest, even as I moved out of journalism, it continues to just be an interest, the wellness space and health and science news.
Amazing. Well, I would love to ask you the main question of the podcast. I'd love for you to, it's kind of a statement too. It's like between a question and a statement. I would love for you to share any stories. It could be one story, a couple of stories where you feel like you've either witnessed or experienced something that you thought was magical or miraculous, or maybe even mysterious. I'd love to hear whatever you'd like to share.
Yeah. I think one I'm going to share, and gosh, there's a few, but I'm going to stick with one. Happened when I was about 16 and we were on vacation with another family and we were in Kauai and it was February. And that's the small, and this was a long, long time ago. That's the, one of the smaller islands of Hawaii and it gets a lot of rain. In February, we just had nothing but storms. And the other family, and boy, so I was like the one left out. Like my parents had friends, my brother had friends, and it was me. And there was a brief moment of good weather. We went to a beach and a man had a heart attack and died in the surf. And my mom helped to pull him out. And we witnessed this and they were trying to give him CPR. It was very frightening, right? I mean, it's a tragic thing is even all these years later, as I'm telling, to see and witness. And we went back to condo where we were staying. And I don't even know if it was the same day because it's really blended. And the storms came in again. And I sort of went out on a bluff and the wind was blowing and the waves. I think, you know, you're thinking about life and how could this happen? And who is this man's family? And in that moment, I don't think the wind stopped and the sun came out and the waves stopped crashing. I don't actually think those things happened. It's the funny thing with an experience like that. It felt like it did. And the voice I heard was, sort of about being brave, leaning in, like you're here for a reason. And I didn't have anything to do and the poor man died. So it's not like I saved someone, but it was one of those really clear messages that I interpreted as there can be chaos all around you and you can feel stillness. Cause I would have sworn at that magical moment, the wind stopped, the sun came out, the waves stopped crashing. I don't actually think that. I think that was the experience of peace that I felt at a time that was so emotionally, I felt alone and isolated on the vacation. It wasn't that kind of vacation. We had just witnessed something truly tragic and terrible. And that's the moment. And, you know, until I've told you this story and I told you the Camino story about during a storm, I'm very curious about what storms represent to me, because I've now winged out two storm stories and that's a surprise to me.
I don't know. I've always thought of storms as both and, you know, they seem, depending on how... I don't know, violent the storm is, it can be complete chaos. You can have terrible winds and maybe branches of trees are breaking down in the neighborhood, or terrible lightning and the lightning strikes something, or thunder that maybe makes the whole house shake. But then afterwards, after the storm moves on, it's like everything is renewed and the birds are going crazy and everything's sparkling and shimmering with raindrops. And it's like this, almost like this really violent benediction, the kind of benediction that you don't want, because it's, everybody thinks benediction is this really sweet, soft word of something miraculous, you know, being visited upon you. But I just now during this conversation, I'm contemplating the fact that even a violent storm afterwards, nature is like, oh my gosh, this, thank you. You know,
no, that's so beautiful. I love the adjectives and the description, and it ties to screenwriting, because I thought that is so beautifully said. And I think that the storm and then what emerges afterwards, what's washed away, what's left, it sort of gets in that duality that I think is, you know, humans having this experience, we're grappling with all the time, right? So much of it is and, right? It is just and we would like it because it would be more comfortable to be or, like, black or white, good, bad, right? And it would be easier for all of us and we wouldn't have the dilemmas, and just so much of it is and, you know, talk about full circle moments. I'm thinking to your first question, I said, you know, it's every day I'm sort of evolving. I think that's the answer. When I was younger, I had so much more certainty because I needed that certainty. Right? I didn't have the, if you will, the soul, the emotional capacity to hold all of that. And that's probably been the grace of living in the different experiences and of playing with art, of meditation, of journaling, of prayer, of really sort of spending time in contemplation, is it's helped me get so much more comfortable with, it's probably all an and.
I do have to say I'm 53 and I, you know, when I was younger, I felt like I kind of knew everything.
Oh gosh.
Totally. Like I got this, I got a handle on this. You don't know what you're talking about. But now as I've gotten older, I kind of understand how much I just do not know.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of excited about it. It makes life really exciting.
You know, it makes life super exciting if you want to be curious about it and you want to accept that you don't know if something will be good or bad. I think that, you know, coming full circle to curiosity, as we create whatever's next in our lives and things happen that maybe surprise us and we want to think it's bad or all bad, there's that realizing you don't know. I mean, Japan and Vietnam, two countries that at different points, part, you know, is North Vietnam, we've been at war with, where Americans died, where people have died, where there's this history. And yet both in the relationships and the people. It's like, it's all, and I mean, now horribly moving and so much tragedy there, but you just recognize, you know, how much things can change, not even a full generation. Yeah, it's humbling. I think that's the word. I turned 60 this past year, and I am more in love with life and more humbled by life than I have ever been.
What a gorgeous way to be in the world. I'm hoping, I feel like I'm on track to where you are. I feel like I'm on that track, but I just am in love with the sentiment of living life with the idea always and, because for me, that just makes everything way more exciting and more fun. And there's so much more potential.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Cause then you get curious and then you create something new and better. Otherwise you're hiding and hunkering and clinging to maybe something that is past. Right.
Absolutely. Yes. Here's to creating better things, saying, yes. And
yes, absolutely.
That's a wrap on my conversation with Susan. I really enjoyed talking to her, and I just so appreciate what she has given to the world in the form of this book. I think with all of us, or for most of us, I should say, you know, we have these lives where we go to work to make money. Our job might not be our greatest desire, and so we have to find what makes our heart happy, what makes our souls sing out after work, maybe after 5 o'clock, or maybe on the weekends. And I think this journal, this book that Susan has created, I think it's another way to discover what makes us happy. There will be a link in the episode show notes to click on to Susan's website, and then another link if you want to buy her book. And I talk in the episode about the front being so clean and it's easy to read. And I just love things that, you know, are beautiful like that, that are simple like that. And then you open it and you can have your own adventure. I really encourage you to support Susan in getting the book, and in getting the book, discovering another magical part of yourself. Thanks to everyone who listens. Please do consider leaving a rating or writing a little review. It means so much to me. You really have no idea. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Susan. Be an adventurer. Whether Susan is adventuring all over the world, I think, what did she say? 92 countries? Whether she's going out there in the world having adventures or opening that gorgeous art journal, not knowing what it's going to bring forth out of her, not knowing what it's going to evoke out of her. And that's its own kind of adventure. I mean, you can have an adventure out in the world, or you can have an adventure right in your living room. So be like Susan, believe in the adventure, and every time you step out of your front door, make a promise to yourself that your day is going to be full of surprises, full of fun, and full of strangers who ultimately become your friends.